and welcome to another episode of the Fantasy Writers Toolshed. I'm your host, Richie Billing, and in this episode, we're continuing our series on creating lifelike characters with an in-depth look at sociology. To help me do that, I'm thrilled to welcome to the Toolshed, N. Burke, who has a PhD in sociology and also has two podcasts that look at true crime and also The Wheel of Time. So N is also a massive fantasy fan as well. I've also got a bunch of calls for submissions for you and a free writing tool in the form of a list of publishers of fantasy novels, the link to which you can find in the description. If you enjoy listening to the show, please consider following or subscribing to ensure you never miss an episode. If you have the time, I'd be ever so grateful if you left us a quick review. And Spotify has this new rating system, which I can only seem to find it on the mobile app. So if you do have a few moments to spare, a quick review on that would be amazing. And a massive thank you to everyone who's already left a review on Spotify. I think we're rocking a 4.6 out of 5 so far, so that's pretty reassuring. And if you know of any other writers or you're part of any forums or writing groups, then please consider sharing the show with them too. Both myself and everyone who gets involved in the podcast, we all do this for the love of writing and of helping others. So word of mouth recommendations is our primary marketing strategy, and it's how we've been able to get thousands of listeners so far. So thank you to each and every one of you. If you'd like to get involved and join our writing groups, you can find the link in the description. We congregate on Facebook and Discord, and you can get help with everything from beta reading your stories and discussing ideas, as well as just staying in the loop with the likes of calls for submissions, writing news and writing tips and guides. If you'd like to take your learning beyond this podcast, you can find lots of fantasy writing classes, workshops and books on our Patreon page. Again, the link for that is in the description. And now on with the show. And I'm delighted to welcome to the Toolshed for the very first time, N. Burke, for a chat about sociology and how it can help shape who our characters are. I'm delighted to welcome N. Burke to the Toolshed today. N, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, thank you. How are you?
I'm not too bad. Not too bad at all. I'm really happy to have you here because I've been chatting to N on Reddit. That's how we got talking, isn't it? And
yes.
I discovered that N hosts two podcasts, Cool Story and Rip from the Headlines. And Cool Story is all about the Wheel of Time, which I believe you created especially for the TV series. Is that right?
Kind of in anticipation of it. We've been doing it for about 2 years, but really, I just wanted an excuse to talk about one of my favorite book series with my best friend who had never read it. So it's kind of a veteran reader, first-time reader podcast.
That's cool. I've not seen the season. I've only read the first book as well. I absolutely loved the first book. And I don't know why I never went back. I think maybe I was just daunted by the number of...
The other 15 books can sometimes be intimidating to folks, I think, but it's one of the like richest book series I've read of really fully developed characters. And there's like 200 of them by the time you get to the end of the series, but each of them is really distinct and unique in a lot of ways. So it's kind of fun to pull that apart.
Nice. So how have you found the season? Has it been true to the books? Have you enjoyed it?
You know, so people have very polarized opinions on the TV series. I think for folks who had it like set in their minds what it should look like for so long, have some negative reactions to things. Ultimately, it's not perfectly true to the books, but you could never have a TV series cover, you know, 15 books that are 400 some on pages each and have that be a weekly TV series. So ultimately, I'm fine with the changes they made, and I kind of think of it as like a cover of my favorite song. So it's different, but I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, I love cover songs. So it's a great way to describe it. I just wanted to mention your other podcast too, Rip from the Headlines, because it's all about true crime and specifically looks at stories that inspired Law and Order. Is that right?
Yes. So Law and Order, we're going back and recapping the original episodes from the early 1990s and talking about the true crimes that inspired each of the episodes. And it's kind of fun because, I have my PhD in sociology, so I think a lot about sort of the social forces that underpin the way that society works. And yeah. So for me, it's kind of fun to take that and put it in conversation with a medium that really is like pro policing and pro, you know, the justice system, and thinking about the ways that that actually works in the real world. So it's really a fun way to kind of have some fun talking about the topics with Law and Order. And then when we get into the true crimes that inspired it, we get to kind of be a bit more serious and talk about, power and inequality and all of those sorts of things.
Really cool. I have listened to a few episodes as well, and I've enjoyed them. So please
thank
do
you.
Everyone go out and check out these two great shows.
Thank you.
The reason I was keen to get in on the show was because, like you mentioned just then, you've got a PhD in sociology.
I do, yes.
Yeah, and that's your background, is that right?
Yeah, so I did, my undergrad was in sociology, then decided to apply to grad school and got my master's and PhD in sociology from University of Southern California in Los Angeles.
Congratulations.
And my kind of areas of expertise are like race, gender, and sexuality in like workplaces and in education were kind of like my expertise areas.
That's all very relevant at the moment. So,
yes. Yes. Thank you.
Now, as a few listeners may already know, in previous episodes, we've looked at something called the bone structure, which is a way of creating almost lifelike characters. And we do this by defining three dimensions of a character or a person. We start with the physiology, which is how that person appears, the sociology, which is what we're going to explore today, and the product of them two gives us the psychology of that character, which we've also looked at in past episodes. So, sociology then.
Mm-hmm.
I love exploring this because, that cliche line, I always come back to it. Society made me like this. And some truth in it, I think. I don't know about you. You're obviously the expert here. But
yeah.
is there truth in that, do you think? Does sociology and society shape who we are?
I think, yes, absolutely. I think it has a huge, huge influence on who we are. I think the tricky thing with that, society made me who I am kind of thing is sociology society has tremendous influence on us, particularly based on kind of our social location, where we were born, how we were raised, all of that sort of stuff. And also sociology really looks at the agency of individuals to either, navigate those patterns in society or to push against and resist them and create change either for oneself or for another group. And so, yes, I think sociology would say like, yes, it makes us who we are, or at least it informs the way that we view and navigate the world.
That's very well explained. And it is a very broad subject, isn't it? And I don't think we could nail it all in a quick 20 minutes or so. So I was going to ask you about, it makes sense, doesn't it, to start with when we're born, our parents, siblings, relationships, the hobbies and interests that we develop, our home life, essentially,
mm-hmm.
that has a fundamental impact on who we grow up to become.
Mm-hmm.
So can you tell us a bit about that and the influence that has?
Yeah, absolutely. Just before we started recording, we talked about kind of a few different themes like religion and family and all of that. All of those are what in sociology we would refer to as agents of socialization, which is the way in which an individual learns the values and the norms of a given society. And so each of those agents of socialization is kind of tasked with the orientation toward normalcy in society, essentially, and toward holding similar values. So for family, you'll see often folks or kind of those major influences are looking at putting one's family before others, respecting elders in that family, taking care of others. Caretaking is a huge, huge thing in the sociology of families, because you can look at things like, when parents are aging, who is responsible for taking care of them? And that sort of responsibility often falls on the women members of a family. So if you have a bunch of siblings whose parents are ill or sick or dying, it's often the women in the family who are sort of responsible, quote unquote, for taking care of those parents. Of course, that's not something necessarily that we explicitly state, right? Like nobody is born and we say like, you are responsible for taking care of our aging parents, but those expectations and those norms are reinforced in many different ways. And so you'll often see kind of consistent themes about what family means to people and what the expectations are around that for people.
Yeah.
And that's going to vary a lot from society to society or culture to culture. Some families, it'll be in the 1950s in America, it was all about the nuclear family, the mother, the father, the 2.5 children and the white picket fences. Yeah. Apologies. All of my context is going to be United States, but
that's fine.
that's sort of what the family looked like. And you saw that reinforced in kind of the different norms of society to say, this is what family means.
Yeah.
In other cultures, it's really common for multiple generations to be living together, for children to be raised by aunts, uncles, grandparents, cousins. And so you'll see a far broader context of what family means.
It's amazing to look at the contrast, isn't it? Because when you were talking there about that nuclear family of like the white picket fences and everything, mm-hmm. I always remember learning about this. I think it must have been in politics about how governments or certain governments at the time, at different times, saw promoting mm-hmm. a sort of stable family would help sort of like the economy or all different kinds of things, really. It's amazing that that's what your government's trying to drive into.
Yes, I think a Marxist perspective on sort of the family would look at what function it serves relative to the economy. And so for the United States particularly, but really any sort of capitalist society or culture has a vested interest in maintaining the reproduction of a workforce. And so you'll see states or countries having various sort of laws or benefits to enforce a specific structure of what family means. And you see that through things like there are tax credits to people who get legally married. There are taxes that everybody in society pays to raise children, to fund public education. And so you'll see the sort of expectations around what family should look like, how it should operate, reinforced by multiple agents of socialization, right? So the family doesn't exist in a vacuum. It exists in the context of the politics and the religion and other social structures within the society.
But because who's to say what's right at the end of the day when these are just all sort of driven on us, aren't they? All these, like we say, through the medium of like governments, religion, all these different things are telling us to live our lives in a certain way or promoting us to do so.
Yep.
When you take a step back, it's like, well, you might be wrong.
Yes. And I think that a really helpful lens perhaps for writers would be thinking about the context of power, because all of the sort of norms and values that you'll see in a society are in the interest of maintaining power. And yeah. So, respecting your elders in the family is maintaining a sense of power of the family's elders. This sort of democratic system is about maintaining power of people who are kind of often already in positions of power in society. It's uncommon in the United States, at least, for our politicians, especially at the highest levels, to really come from lower class or working class backgrounds. They're often the children of former politicians or people in prestigious, well-connected families. So you'll see what I'm trying to say with that is that you'll see those sort of like norms and laws really structured in a way that maintains the existing status quo of power.
Yeah, it's amazing. So I just wanted to bring it back a bit and talk about the influence that parents can have and mm-hmm. what our parents believe, what they do. How does, I mean, I see it a lot in different all different kinds of people and the mm-hmm. influence that the parents have had on them. And sometimes it's obviously good and sometimes it's obviously bad, but what can you explain that to
yeah. us? So again, the family teaches us a lot of norms about society, but it's not the only one that does that. It's interesting. Studies actually show that peer groups tend to be more influential on children's sort of perspectives of the world than necessarily their family. But generally, what you will see is if you have children who are in a family that they kind of view as functional, like they don't see a lot of dysfunction in their family, they will often replicate the sort of belief systems and the practices that their parents believe are correct, that they kind of reinforce. You know, for example, my father was in the military, and he was so regimented about time. And so I have a like compulsive on time means you're late and 10 minutes early means you're on time kind of thing, because that was sort of the belief that he held when, you know, based on his military training, and that then influenced our family.
Excellent. And of course, keepers.
Yes. And of course, you know, all of that interacts with our own individual psyche. I'm also a person who has anxiety, and maybe that was because of things like that, but maybe it's also just a thing that, you know, is my own kind of thing, and it interacts with that, and it sort of like feeds each other. But yeah, you'll often see children kind of looking to the family that they came from as either a model or a cautionary tale, as kind of what they want their future family to look like. One of the challenges right now, I don't know if this is a challenge, but one of the patterns I think right now is you're seeing a generation of people come of sort of the what would be seen as sort of the normal age to be having children, getting married, buying a house sort of thing. But the economy has gotten to a place where folks who are entering the like age where they would typically have children and things like that, it's much more difficult to have the sort of financial security that previous generations of similar ages had. And so we are often, you know, in the 30 and 40 year old range right now, forming sort of different family structures because of the economy. So we're seeing, at least in the United States, more multi-generational families living together with grandparents or uncles and cousins because housing is so expensive, because wages have not kept pace with inflation. And so a family of four can't survive on a single income the way it could in the 1950s. So those sorts of things have a really strong influence on the structure of the family, and then therefore the things that the family kind of values or expects of each other.
That's the way you just explained that then, it's really excellent. And it's, I think from a writer's perspective, to be in control and to sort of understand the knock-on effects that different things have on your fantasy world, for example, or your society. That's a really good point. And yeah, it's the same issue here in the UK. Like people, like I'm 30 now. I'm lucky enough now to earn enough to move out and get my own place. But for a long time, I lived with my mum up to like the age of 28 because it was so expensive you couldn't afford. Well, it still is. And a lot of people I know are living with parents well into the 30s. So it's just a norm now, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I'm currently living in what used to be my grandparents' house, and it was remodeled into a duplex where originally my mom owned one half and my grandmother lived in the other half, and my mom kind of took care of my grandma. And then when she passed away, I bought my grandma's half of the house. And now I'm kind of there taking care, not taking care of necessarily, but there as a kind of, you know, support for my mother, especially as she's getting older. So you see things like that happening a lot more based on where the economy is, because if we were in an economy like the 1950s, she might still have her own house and I might be able to afford my own house. But cost of living has gotten so much that, you know, things like that are much more common right now than they were in the past. So thinking about the kind of economics of your society is definitely going to have a big impact on what families look like.
Yeah, nice. Something that I wanted to come back to, you mentioned earlier, was the influence of your peer groups. Because that was really interesting.
Yeah, so peer groups are an interesting... are an interesting, you know, force of socialization for individuals. One of the processes by which we learn what the norms and values are of a society is through kind of the policing of what is not acceptable. And so peer groups are hugely influential because as children, we desperately want to be part of the group and be part of who is included and respected and all that kind of thing. And so we are, as children, like really terrified of doing anything that will paint us as strange or weird or outside the norms. And so we'll do a lot of things to kind of conform and fit in childhood that we might not do in later life. You know, you kind of see like people as they get older, it's like, I care less and less what people think about me as I get older. But as children, that is so important. And part of that is because of the process of policing, where anytime children see things outside of the norm, they will find ways to shame or shun or exclude that person. And so you'll kind of have like, you know, the people who are closest in approximation to people in positions of power, which in the United States and in a lot of the world society is like white, straight, cisgender, heterosexual men. And anything that deviates from that tends to be kind of policed or shunned. So you'll see young boys particularly are a really good example. They will... you know, they'll shame each other. They'll tease each other for anything that is perceived as like feminine or effeminate behavior. Yeah. They will use homosexuality as a kind of, you know, bludgeoning tool to force people into what they expect of like gender norms. You know, they'll tease them for holding their hand in a certain way or speaking in a certain way or being interested in certain things. Yeah. You know, I being a queer and trans person myself, I have countless examples from childhood that I could give you of ways that that happens. But it's peer groups, peers are hugely influential because we want a sense of belonging. And it's not an assumed or taken for granted like it is in family. I feel like in families, we often have a little bit more wiggle room in who we are, in exploring our identity, than we often do with peer groups, because they are so kind of collective in the groupthink of what people should do or beliefs that they have or things that they should be interested in. And they enforce that a lot through teasing and through exclusion, through bullying.
It's really excellent points. I went through bullying in school and really struggling to find your place in it amongst everybody else, I suppose. But it's, I don't know. I think you learn a lot from things like that, don't you?
Absolutely.
You learn a lot about other people too. And yeah, it's all about... Speaking of other people and learning a lot from them, I wanted to segue into the influence of religion. Because I think religion, especially in fantasy, it's really prominent. Mm-hmm. And if we look at probably like the likes of Game of Thrones, how significant religion was in that, not just religion, but belief systems and faith. Mm-hmm. So how did they influence? I mean, I know some people who just devote themselves to it. So there's obviously a spectrum of it, isn't it? So some insights.
It's interesting. Religion is, I mean, I find, obviously I got my PhD in sociology, so I find these things interesting, but religion is so interesting because it does have a tremendous influence not only on individuals, but also just generally on a society, kind of looking at what is the dominant religion of any culture will tell you a lot about what people expect of the individuals within that society. So,
strike!
Tell me something I don't know, Ump.
Well, unlike that nasty curveball, there aren't any surprises when you finance your next car with Carvana. You get real terms personalized for you right in your strike zone.
Really?
Steeride!
How am I supposed to focus when you're telling me about Carvana?
Well, Slugger, you gotta keep your eye on the ball. Just like you can keep an eye on your customized down and monthly car payments.
I can customize those?
He's out and on his way to finance his next car with Carvana.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to get pre-qualified today. We'll drive you happy at Carvana.
You know, like Christian religion, for example, in the United States often sort of says that, you know, men should be with women and that influence, even though it's from religion and doesn't necessarily, not everybody believes that or holds to it or reinforces that, but because it is the dominant belief in a society, you see it being influenced in, or you see it influencing all of the other aspects of it. So one of the reasons we see, you know, laws like tax benefits for married people are because the people who are in positions of power passing the laws and voting on the laws are often the people of that dominant religion in the society. So even if it's technically a separation of church and state, you will often see the sort of like guiding influences of a religion shaping the decisions people are making in politics. So, or any other context really, but religion is hugely influential in sort of people's sense of purpose in life. Is the purpose in life, you know, some religions, this world is about suffering and we gain peace and an end to suffering in the afterlife. Others believe that, you know, the most important thing is achieving the most in this world to demonstrate that you are a good person who is bound for this certain kind of afterlife. So, yeah. So it's tremendously influential in really broad ways, I think, that will kind of guide the choices that people make and what they see as good or bad. I remember taking a class in undergrad where the professor was talking about sort of the origins of racism and kind of comparing the United States to, I believe Brazil was his comparison. And he talked about how in the Bible, there was the curse of Ham. I'm not a biblical expert, so I'm sure lots of other people know more about this than I do. But he had all of these analyses of the Bible that looked at how the curse of Ham was kind of a association with like darkness, like the curse made the person was laid upon him, I believe, because he had, you know, made bad decisions, whatever. And it kind of got associated with like darker skin tone, darker complexion. And you see that a lot in fantasy, obviously, right? Like the bad guy is always like dressed in black and things are dark and that equates badness. And so he was able to kind of like track this back to this sort of like biblical curse and make arguments for how this influenced the slave trade to the Americas. And so you'll often see these really, really interesting ways that religion influences things, right? People were okay with engaging in the slave trade because they believed these people were less than human. And that came from certain religious beliefs. At least that was his argument. So you'll definitely, the belief system of your society is going to have really big implications for not only family structure, but, you know, who is good, who is seen as moral and pious in a society.
Yeah.
People will often make decisions leading them toward that.
Yeah. So it's one thing that sprung to mind then, and when you're saying about how religions shape and influence society and the way they use it as a justification to believe that they're right or they've got some sort of divine reason to be doing what they're doing. Mm-hmm. I always think back to the Crusades and like all these Western countries decided that it was okay in the name of God to go and try and take over.
Yeah. And I mean,
Judaism
and
stuff like that. It's bizarre.
And so many monarchs throughout history have been a monarch because they are supposedly closer to God than the common person, right?
Yeah,
so
that was it. Yeah.
You'll kind of see things like that showing up in who has power as well. The folks who are closest to godliness are those often who have positions of power.
Yeah. And one thing I blame is a large part of it, definitely. We do cover a bit of history on this show, and mm-hmm. I love studying history as well. And when Christianity first came to England, mm-hmm. it was a fairly equal society. Mm-hmm. But because Christianity promotes this sort of ideal of a woman, which is centered around the Virgin Mary, mm-hmm. you just see a complete destruction of any sort of sense of equality, which mm-hmm. is still enduring today. Like at one point, the law, as sort of decreed by the church, was that women were regarded as a type of infant mm-hmm. and that they were a piece of property.
Yeah. It's shocking. Like, to me, it's shocking that you still see things like that today. I had a cousin who recently got married, and in their wedding vows was this whole thing about the wife being subservient to the husband and following his orders and all that kind of stuff. And it's just wild to me that people still think things like that and believe things like that sometimes. But, you know, again, belief systems are hugely important because they give people a purpose in life. They explain through the act of what death means and what is after death, it gives the meaning to life for people. And so I think for folks who do have that really deep connection to religion, it can have a much stronger influence, I think, on, you know, things like gender dynamics or, you know, other aspects of life.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And moving away from religion, one mm-hmm. thing I wanted to ask you about was the likes of education and occupation and
yes.
the opportunities that opens up for different people and things like that. So can you shed a bit of light on that?
Yeah. One of the things that I think is really interesting to think about with regard to education and employment is at least I think this is a pretty commonly held belief in the world broadly, but certainly very, very strongly held in the United States is the idea that education is a means of advancement in society, that if you are studious and you get into a good college and you get your college degree, that it will afford you opportunities to get better paying jobs, to advance in society, et cetera. The question becomes whether that is true or a useful fiction for people. Because you'll look at things like in the United States, we have record number of first generation students in college, which means that their parents never went to college. They're the first in their family to have done so. But often our first generation students have less financial resources than their parents or than other peers at the college. So their parents often can't pay for it, which means they're accumulating a lot of student debt, which then you kind of wonder, all right, maybe I'm getting a higher paying job with this ultimately, but I'm saddled with debt that I will be carrying around till the end of my life, essentially. So things like that, I think, are kind of like worth questioning. What do we say about education? And then what also actually happens within education, right? The sort of beliefs aren't necessarily always reflected in the outcomes. And that, you know, it has implications not only for the finances of navigating education, but also just the knowledge of how to navigate a system like, you know, a college. If you are a college student who has not only family members or parents who have gone to college before you, but maybe even the college you are going to, you kind of have built-in advisors and guides within your own family who can tell you, oh, you're having this problem, go talk to this person. Oh, you need to get, you know, whatever application submitted by this time. These classes are the important ones. These are the majors that are valued. That creates a really, really different experience than a first generation student who is trying to do literally all of that on their own because they do not have family members who can provide them advice and guidance of navigating an institution of higher education. So thinking about kind of the connection between education and the economy and the family, right? All of these things are interconnected and are going to have a really big influence on not only how one experiences education, but also what the result is afterwards if you're pursuing some kind of degree.
Yeah. And I suppose it's sort of, like you say, as I said at the beginning, sociology, it's all connected. And to look at it in its component parts is doing it a bit of a disservice. And one thing that we spoke about before was the influence of governments. Mm-hmm. And things like that. And this affects education as well, because personally, I think education should be free for everybody.
Yeah.
But in our country in particular, in the UK, we're now shifting from a public education system to one that's privatized, essentially. Mm-hmm. And schools mm-hmm. are run like a business mm-hmm. for profit.
Yeah.
And that's just sickening for me.
Yeah. Even I work at University of California, Santa Barbara, and the UC system is one of the largest economies in the world. I think if you were to look just at the money flowing in and out of the University of California system, I think we are larger than a significant portion of other countries in the world. And so there's so much money flowing in and through education, but most of it and more of it over time is coming from private funding sources. The state and federal allocation of funds to higher education have not increased over time, but the cost of running a college has increased over time. And so what that means is more and more of the cost of running a university has fallen on things like tuition and fees for students, because if our federal and state government aren't giving us money to run the university, we either have to get it from corporations or we have to get it from the people who are attending the college. And so you like you were saying, you kind of see the privatization, the corporatization of higher education happening in really interesting and problematic ways. One of the things that I often deal with in my job is we, as a research university, we have many corporate funders of our research, particularly in STEM fields. So like in engineering, we have research that is funded by defense organizations. And that is a conflict for a lot of people because it, you know, for some people would argue, this is money we need in order to do research. Whereas some people would say, this is a company that creates weapons of destruction that allow for, you know, a spread of imperialism around the world, a spread of colonization. And so you'll higher education is in a very interesting place right now. I guess what I'm trying to say, because of where the money is coming from that allows it to function. So, you know, I hate to always reduce things down to this, but looking at where the money comes from and who has the power to make decisions about something are going to have huge impacts on what it looks like. And because that money is not coming from necessarily taxes and coming from the public as it used to, corporations have tons of power in universities that they didn't used to have. They often sit on the boards of universities and make decisions about what is valued education. And so then you get into really interesting things like if these are the people who are on boards of universities and they're also, you know, the CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, they get to make decisions about allocation of money towards specific areas. And of course, they will allocate it toward those areas that then benefit them. So they will give lots of fellowships and grants and job opportunities to people who are engaged in research or science in their area. So the defense organizations will fund people in mechanical and electrical engineering who are then going to be the workforce that supports that organization. So it's really, really an interesting time in education.
Yeah. And what I'm really enjoying about this particular part of the conversation is that what we're seeing is loads of conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And as writers, we're going to try and bring it back to writing now.
Yeah.
Conflict is the fuel of our stories.
Yes.
So hopefully, if you've been listening to N, you've got a sense of how all these different parts of sociology can conflict with each other. And this is, I can feel stories there, you know what I mean? When you're talking mm-hmm. about things like that, it's ideas are coming to me about like different stories that you could try and write about. So before we finish, I just wanted to ask you whether you've got any, because I understand you're a bit of a writer yourself.
I am.
Have you got any advice for any writers who are looking to maybe learn about a bit more about sociology or use sociology in their stories to make them unique, to give them that original edge?
Yeah, I can recommend like a couple of sources. I think questions that I try to think about in world building are things like, where is the power? Who has power? What does that look like? How is that power exercised? How do people push against that power? You know, and that'll look really different in a democratic society. Maybe it would look like voting. In a totalitarian society, maybe it would look like guerrilla warfare. So it's going to be really different based on what that power structure looks like. So power and money are going to be two hugely, hugely influential things that I think any writer would want to have really worked out to help shape the world and make it feel realistic.
Yeah,
of course. And religion, of course, all of them, all of the agents of socialization are really important. But, you know, asking about power, I think, is a really important one. As far as things to learn more about sociology, gosh, I mean, the Communist Manifesto is one of the, I think, foundational texts in understanding how power and money form a society and bound a society. So not necessarily going to give you all of the tenets of sociology, but certainly an interesting lens into power and economy and the way that that shapes all of the other structures of society. Gosh, I mean, I would have to look at my bookshelf and see what some of the other texts are that I would recommend. But I'd be happy to send you some other recommendations that you can share with folks on future episodes if you'd like.
That'd be awesome. Thanks so much.
Yeah. Of course.
And it's been fantastic chatting with you. I've learned so much and I've got quite animated at times.
Well, I really enjoyed this as well. Like I said, I obviously am a big nerd. Otherwise, I would not have gotten a PhD in this and spent like 10 years of my life studying it. But yeah, I hope if you have any questions for me in the future, happy to come back. Or if other folks want to reach out to me, you know, they can contact me through my two different podcasts' email addresses.
Yeah. And can we find you on social media too?
Yes. So I think the easiest one is through my true crime podcast. My social media is Ripped Headlines Pod on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And email is rippedheadlinespod@gmail.com. And I'm happy to answer any questions anybody has if they want to kind of learn any more about things that I talked about.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Of course.
I'm sure everyone else does as well.
Of course. My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much. Speak to you soon. I'd like to say another huge thank you to N. Berk for taking the time to share their wisdom. Like I said before, I really did enjoy our chat. I got some great ideas for stories and lots of ideas to help me create my characters too. And I hope you found it just as useful as well. I've got a few announcements for you now. First up, I wanted to let you know about my list of fantasy publishers for long fiction. Not long ago, I updated this page with new publishers. There are around 50 or 60 on there altogether at the moment. You can find a mix of elite publishers to indie presses with details on what word counts they're looking for, what they pay, and what their response time is. You can access this list for free in two different ways. First, you can view the list as well as download it via my website, where the link to which you can find in the description. Or you can just download this list directly through the description via that link. I sincerely hope it helps. I update it regularly, so I always suggest bookmarking the page in your browser. And if you join our writing group too, you'll also be notified whenever it gets updated. Speaking of publishers, I've got a few calls for submissions for you now. First up, Mithilia Review is inviting submissions for a special global hope punk issue of science fiction and fantasy devoted to positive and powerful character-driven stories that imagine an open and inclusive tech-empowered democratic future for all people, species, and countries on Earth. They're looking for bold new visions of democracy that question what democracy is, how it functions, things like that. The payment is 8 cents per word. The deadline is the 20th of May, 2022. And just head to mithiliareview.com to find out more. If you're not sure how that's spelled, it's M-I-T-H-I-L-I-A review.com. New magazine Seize the Press is looking for dark, transgressive, speculative fiction, particularly short stories. There's no submission deadline, as far as I can see, and the word count is under 2,000 words, which is quite strict. They pay 6 cents per word, but they don't take reprints. So if you write bleak sci-fi, dark fantasy, and horror, seizethepress.com is the place you want to be. Shoreline of Infinity is open for general submissions between the 11th and 14th of March. Very narrow window. They're looking for science fiction and fantasy short stories up to 6,000 words, and they pay £40 per 1,000 words, which is pretty good. Simultaneous submissions are fine, and please only submit one story per submission period. Apparently, they've also announced a flash fiction contest, so check that out on their webpage, shorelineofinfinity.com/submissions. Orion's Belt is open for submissions starting the 1st of March. They're looking for stories no longer than 1,200 words, and they pay 8 cents per word for original stories, and they don't actually take reprints at all. You can find out more at orions-belt.net/submissions. And lastly, one of the big publishers, Lightspeed, is open to submissions until the 1st of May for flash fiction only. That's a limit of 1,500 words. They pay 8 cents per word. There's no reprints or simultaneous submissions. For everything for Lightspeed, it all goes through the Moksha system. If you do submit, good luck, and please write in with your outcome to thefantasywriterstoolshed@gmail.com. Lastly, I've got some community announcements I'm delighted to share with you. It's been a little while since I've included this feature, and I've been keen to hear what you've all been up to. So there've been some great achievements to celebrate, and congratulations to everybody on the list here. If you'd like to feature in our shout-out section yourself, please email in at thefantasywriterstoolshed@gmail.com. Firstly, congratulations to E. Probilski, who has a story called Daughter of Spring coming out as part of a mini-thology series published by N.D. Gray. Well done there. Congratulations to David McTaggart, who's just sent off his 260,000-word epic fantasy, Fires of Redemption, to his editor. That is 4.5 years of work that David's invested, so really well done there. Well done to Bart and Paul Levinson for the excellent review from Kirkus Reviews of his book Another Century. And lastly, well done to Laverne Spencer-McCarthy on the publication of two new books, Unhallowed Musings, a collection of short, weird stories, and Panorama of Sonnets, which is all about poetry. Awesome stuff, everyone. Remember, write in to share your own news on the next episode. And that's all we've got time for today. Thank you so much for listening. If you did enjoy the show, please consider subscribing or following. Please also consider leaving us a quick review or a Spotify rating through your mobile app, and share the show with your writing friends, your writing group, or anyone you think may be interested. It really does make the world of difference. You can also take your learning beyond the show in two simple ways. First, join our writing group. We're on Facebook, we're on Discord, and we're open to everyone of all genres. Simply ask questions, get feedback on your stories, and stay up to date with the writing world. It's the best place to do it, if you ask me. Not at all biased. Secondly, you can check out our Patreon page. You can find fantasy writing classes, workshops, books, and much more. The links for everything are in the description. Thanks so much for listening again today. We'll be back in a few weeks with more fantasy writing help and inspiration. Until then, keep on scribbling.